You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey you, welcome to this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. I am chatting with Virgie Tovar about her new book, You Have the Right to Remain Fat. It is such a rich, luscious conversation. We talk about dating and sexism and feeling free in your body the way that you did when you were a kid before you ever knew you should be self-conscious about it or monitor it. There is so much richness in this conversation. Every time I talk to Virgie, I feel like I leave going, holy shit, I hope that one day I can think like that. So I'm really excited to bring this conversation to you. Patreon supporters, if you support at the $3 level and above at patreon.com/sexgetsreal, I am reading a couple of paragraphs from Virgie's yet to be released book and sharing a little bit about what I read and what I think about it, plus a little bit of tidbits from the ASDA conference that I am attending in Portland right now. So please hop over there to hear your bonus. And if you support at the $5 level and above, there are listener questions waiting for your responses. So please be sure to go and check those out as well. So my birthday happened this weekend, and it was fantastic. We are actually in an Airbnb in Portland right now. If you want to see something funny, be sure to head to my Instagram, Dawn_Sarah, for what greeted us when we arrived at our Airbnb in Portland. But we are having an amazing time. We had dinner with friends. The conference was so fantastic. There are so many people doing really incredible work around eating disorder recovery and bodies and access to respect and love and health and resources. Wonderful stuff. And of course, pleasure and sex fits so beautifully in with that. And I had the immense opportunity of presenting. So I'll talk a little bit more about that in the Patreon bonus as well. So let me tell you about Virgie if you don't already know who she is. Virgie Tovar is an author, activist, and one of the nation's leading experts and lecturers on fat discrimination and body image. She is the founder of Babe Camp, a 4-week online course designed to help women who are ready to break up with diet culture. And she started the hashtag campaign Lose Hate, Not Weight. She has been featured by the New York Times, Al Jazeera, NPR, Tech Insider, and Self Magazine. So here is my chat with Virgie, and then be sure to head over to Patreon for a little exclusive clip from the book and lots more from me. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Virgie. I think this is going to be a fat-tastic chat.
Yes, agree.
So we are here to talk about your new book, The Right to Remain Fat, which is being put out by Feminist Press, and I had an opportunity to read it so that we could have a really yummy talk all about fat phobia and diet culture. And I just want to first say congratulations on like putting a book out into the world, especially about a topic that so many people are going to have so many strong feelings about.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so... I want so many more of these conversations that are really looking at culture and theory.
Yes.
Because it runs so counter to the narrative that we have all internalized that it's us.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just want to start with how your book starts and ends, which to me is pure delight. And, you know, so much of where I've gone in my work the past year or two is around like play, pleasure, joy, delight. Like, how can we invite more play in? And your book starts and ends with this beautiful moment of play around jiggling your naked body.
Yes, exactly.
Can
yes.
you please tell us about the joy that is jiggling your naked body?
Yes. Well, I mean, I was talking with my editor about, I knew that I wanted to start the book with the image of me as a 4-year-old before I was introduced to fat phobia. And it is this, it's essentially, it's this story about, like, it's describing what it feels like to be free, before you're taught, how not to be, you know, by our culture. And so it begins, you know, the first line in the book is, you know, my body used to belong to me. And I'm recalling being a small child and, you know, coming home from, like, my favorite part of the day was when I would come home from running errands with my grandmother, and I would run, you know, from the front door into the bathroom, and I would take all my clothes off, and then I would run back out, into the kitchen, and, I would spread out my arms and legs, and I would, like, jiggle my entire body. Right. and you know, it's like, on the one hand, right, like, my grandmother found this so funny and cute. And so I have this beautiful memory of her just, like, you know, like, bubbly, effervescent laughter that I would do, this. But more than that, I remember the extraordinary sense of joy and pleasure and curiosity, and particularly pleasure, that just flooded my body, that was inspired by the sensation of my body's movement. You know, and, like, I think this is what's so incredible, right? Before fat phobia, I had no context of my body's functionality and movement as shameful, right? And, like, one of the things that we're taught as fat people is that, like, our body moves more than other people's do, and that's a bad thing. Yeah. And as a 4-year-old who hadn't learned that lesson yet, my body's movement was this extraordinary, magical thing that, that could do this special thing. Like, it could move like water. You know, I think I very much saw it as similar to, like, the undulation of water at the beach, or, like, water in the bathtub. And I loved bath time. And so, you know, and it's interesting, right? I don't talk about this in the book, but, like, I was unable to recall that memory until many years after I stopped dieting. I'd actually suppressed that memory. And that's what's so incredible about the human mind, right? Like, we get taught something, and we, through constant bombardment of a negative education, our brain pushes out the memories that counteract that reality. And so, you know, many years into no longer dieting, I finally unearthed that memory. Like, my brain could finally make room for that in the new life that I'd created for myself. And the book kind of ends with, this beautiful moment where I'm, doing work with, fat women in Jamaica as part of, like, a retreat. And one of the things that we do is we take all our clothes off on the beach during the sunrise, and we jiggle and we reenact that 4-year-old, experience of, like, freedom and play. And I think what's incredible about, and we jiggle for a full minute, you know, and it's so powerful because there's this energy release that happens because we don't normally move our bodies that way.
Yeah.
And so there's this extraordinary release of, like, kinetic energy and memory and that child, that childhood access to playfulness, that is so powerful.
That is something I've been trying to really, bring more into my life for that very reason, you know, that ties me to the possibility of a freedom that I have not known for my entire adult life.
Yes.
You know, that freedom of being in a body that just moves because it can, and because it's mine, and because I want to go somewhere or do something, and not because I have to think about how am I moving, how do I look, what do I get from this movement, what does it earn me,
yes.
You know, those kinds of things. So I just, like, the delight that's apparent in the way that the book is bookended, just, like, hit me so hard in the feels, because I've been trying to incorporate that myself of, like, how can I just tap into those small moments of effortlessness and freedom and play in a body that has been deeply traumatized and politicized.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So your book takes on some massive topics that will bring up massive feelings for people, which I, of course, love. That's, like, my bread and butter. and you talk about, like, diet culture and fat phobia and how it relates to sexism, classism, racism. You tie it to, dating and romance and worthiness. And there's just some huge concepts in here. And I'd love to just start with, you were talking about how diet culture and sexism are just inextricably linked. And you quoted Naomi Wolf from The Beauty Myth, that dieting is the most potent political sedative in women's history. And I would love for us to just kind of start there. Like, for people who are just starting to kind of wake up to the conversation and are just starting to find some of this language, it can feel a little fuzzy of like, okay, I know the dieting thing doesn't work and I know I shouldn't feel this bad about my body. And then seeing that it ties to some of these other really massive systems of oppression, I think can be a little overwhelming, and you make it very accessible throughout the book. So I'd love to just kind of talk a little bit about your experience and how you've teased apart the ways that fat phobia and dieting feed and are fed by sexism and misogyny.
Yes. I mean, so I think a lot about, I mean, right, like dieting is one manifestation of sexism. I think of sexism and like all systems of oppression as like this multi-headed hydra, this like monster with many heads. And depending on where your position in society, your head is going to be a little bit different, right? So, you know, if you're a smaller bodied woman, you're experiencing sexism in a particular way. And if you're a bigger bodied woman, you're experiencing it in another way. And so, but it's important to recognize, right, that like, that diet culture, dieting, is really about the subjugation of women's spirits. It's about the extinguishing of women's desire, and to alienate someone from their desire and their humanity is to subjugate, is to subject them to a life of dissatisfaction and unhappiness, right? I think what's really important to recognize is women, through diet culture, women are taught that hunger is imaginary and that it's negative. And right, like the reality of it is that hunger is a human instinct. And so when you tell someone that this thing about them that is very human is either not real or that they should go to extraordinary lengths to suppress it, you're essentially saying, you're asking them to bypass their own humanity, to suppress their own humanity in the name of some other thing, some greater cause, you know? Like I remember, you know, for the first time in my life, probably at, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, having my hunger questioned. Like, are you really hungry for food, or are you just bored? Are you really hungry, or are you just tired? Do you really want that, or is it really just something else? You know, and there's, and this is like, right, this is called gaslighting. When you question a person's experience of events or their own reality, that's called gaslighting, right? And so diet culture is very, 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 very good at mapping on to women's education in gender inferiority. So it's important to recognize, right, like diet culture is kind of, I don't know, it's almost like, I mean, in tech language, it's like an add-on, right?
Yeah.
It's like, right, you already have the application that says, I am less than because I'm a woman. And then diet culture kind of like comes in and is like, oh, you already feel less than because you're a woman, through a series of subtle but never-ending messages from our culture. I'm just going to add this other thing about how you also have to be thin. And it's going to feel like you're doing this for the purpose of self-improvement, but actually it's about like the degradation of your humanity and your spirit. And so for me, right, it's like essentially these are realities that are particularly potent for women, because we live in a culture where we're consistently taught to be silent, to be small, to be quiet, to sacrifice our happiness, our resources, our everything for the culture and for the men in our lives. And so, you know, right, like, and I want to kind of speak to a moment in my own, you know, feminist awakening. And this was before I even understood what diet culture was. This was just understanding gender stuff for the first time in my life. I was 20 years old and I met this group of feminists in college and they started to ask me questions like, did you know that like you don't have to do what men say? Did you know that sex could be pleasurable for you? Did you know that like you don't have to want to get married? Did you know that you didn't have to? And it was just like my answer to each question was no, right? Like, no, yeah. I didn't know that. And I was born in 1982. This isn't, I'm not like from some kind of weird age, right? That like, I mean, God knows, like probably to some people who are listening to this, that sounds like super ancient, but, like second wave feminism had already happened, right? Women had the right to have an abortion. Women were in the workplace, right? This wasn't like 1933 or like 1901, right? Like, you know, this is like a moment, like I'm coming of age after 2000. Mm-hmm. And this is stuff that I'd never heard before. And so, you know, I want to kind of contextualize that and say like, when that is your reality, that you believe that your life belongs to like, men, right? And like that your whole life is meant to be in pursuit of being near them and one of them loving you. Right. It's easy to see how you add a request for like, oh, just suppress your hunger like forever. Is that cool?
Right. You know,
it's such an easy extension when a person's already experiencing sexism. Right. And so I think that there's this particular way, like I say in the book, right, that dieting is the evidence of an epidemic of female unhappiness, right? Because like what is so startling in working with so many women who are actively dieting or are in the midst of an eating disorder, and by the way, I don't see those things as different.
Yeah.
I mean, I use that phrase because definitely as a culture, we see them as on a spectrum, and certainly there is a spectrum, but I don't see dieting as outside of eating disorders. I don't. It's not like it might be in the shallower end, quote unquote, but like, I remember starving myself for months on end and thinking that I was dieting. So I just want to break down that binary that like people who have eating disorders have a pathology and are sad and need help and that dieters aren't that. That's not true. But like, anyway, you know, I think about the ways that like food became dangerous because it meant that I wasn't going to have the kind of discipline over my body that the culture wanted me to have as a woman. And I think the last thing I'm going to say on this topic is there's this extraordinary sociologist named Sandra Gilman who writes about fatness quite a bit, actually. And he writes that dieting is a way that women show the culture that we understand our role and are willing to give into that role. And so it's important to kind of, take dieting, like look at dieting, not just as a behavior that happens on a plate with a fork and knife or not, right? To take it to the next level and see what it means symbolically. And that's a lot what the book is about kind of like, you know, like a little bit taking ourselves out of that microcosmic moment and really giving a little bit of an eagle eye view on, you know, when this happens on a grand scale among hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions of people, we have to start asking ourselves, what does this behavior symbolize?
Yes.
You know?
Yes. And I think one of the things that hit me so hard too, that one, I've kind of had to live my way into as a truth, and you just stated so beautifully, is that diet culture is about disintegrating our self-trust.
Yeah.
And so many people who write into me on the show and who come to me for coaching around sex and relationship issues, you know, I only work with women and queer folks. And the number one question that I get, other than am I normal, am I broken, is how do I even know what I want? And then how do I even ask for it?
Yes. Yes.
You know, and like that to me is such a symptom of this, you know, from the youngest of ages, if we're starting to deny the things that we're feeling in our body and disconnecting from them intentionally because we're told that's what makes us a good human, then how the fuck are we supposed to know what to want when someone's touching us or what feels good in our body because we have such a skewed perspective on pleasure?
Yes, exactly. And I think like that's one of the first things that that girls are asked to do, right? Is like essentially question, extinguish, discipline, get rid of our hunger, right? And hunger is a manifestation of desire. And like, right, to deny someone desire is unconscionable. That's the thing, right? Like people don't realize like the rhetoric around diet culture renders diet culture as innocuous, as like this harmless, in fact, positive behavior, when in fact, right, like it's actually immoral, unconscionable, repugnant, unforgivable, you know? And it just blows my mind, right? Like, I mean, I can relate to what you're saying about hearing this from the folks you're working with, right? Like, I feel like the women I'm working with, the people I see, you know, around the world talking about this issue, right? There's like a complete ungrounding or unmooring of the things that make them human. And diet culture really is that. It's about like rendering you into part of a machine. And that is so damaging to the soul and to the spirit, you know, the things that like humans, like, right, like humans want to feel love. They want to feel connection. We want to feel freedom. We want to feel like these are universal human truths. And I think what's so heartbreaking to me is like, you know, people are doing these dehumanizing diet behaviors and thinking that they're making their lives better. And then they're confused about why they're unhappy. And that's an extraordinary sign of manipulation on a grand scale.
Yeah. Yes. Oh my God. This ties really beautifully into a piece of the book that I loved, which was speaking to this sense of inferiority and the ways that it can show mm-hmm. up. And you were talking about how, and I think this is one of the really seductive things about basically all of the systems of oppression, you know, racism, classism, fat phobia, transphobia, they are very smart and they morph with the culture. So what looked like racism 30 years ago now looks very different, but racism still exists. It's just hard to see.
Yes.
And you were talking about how this sense of inferiority that fat phobia and diet culture put on us, to ask most women, do you feel inferior? The answer would be, well, no, I don't. And so you asked these questions to help people kind of really get under that kind of knee-jerk instinctual no. And I would love to kind of read those questions and then talk a little bit about just kind of like inferiority and worthiness.
Yes.
So the four questions that you posed as part of this lecture you were giving was a sense of inferiority shows up like wearing something that is physically uncomfortable because you believe it makes you look better. A refusal to eat something you wanted to eat because you were worried it might impact the way you look. A refusal to do something you wanted to do because you're worried about how it would make you look to another person. And a denial of an impulse to say no or yes to something that mattered to you because you were worried that someone wouldn't like you if you did that. You know, I mean, like right off the bat, I can think of the thousands of times I've worn something physically uncomfortable just because I thought it made me look more flattering or better, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What are some of the ways you've noticed inferiority showing up in your life?
Yeah, I mean, those questions really come from my own life, right? Like, and this is what's interesting is, like in the book, the story that is sort of the precursor to those questions, is that I've been hired to speak to a group of high school students. And normally I talk to, college students who, you know, are not necessarily that different in age, but a lot of them they're just in a different environment. And also a lot of them have been at least somewhat introduced to the idea you know, like social, like cultural criticism or like the sociology or anthropology or something, like a critical perspective on the culture. And a lot of times at the high school level, that's not part of the school culture in the same way. And so I was trying to kind of get to, right, like, you know, these are, there are lots of people, like you're saying, right? Like, I think if I point blank went up to 1,000 women on the street or 100 women on the street and asked every one of them, do you feel inferior? They'd probably say no. And then, yeah, like, you know, I think what I learned as a, you know, when I was in grad school and doing research on this topic of like fatness, I learned that a lot of times the most obvious question isn't the right question to get to the answer. And, right, like our culture, especially like our culture has adapted so well to sexism and it has obscured sexism so much that, you know, like I think about, right, like let's say, 100 years ago or 70 years ago, if you talk to women and you ask them that same question, they might be a little bit clearer, right? Like, maybe I am inferior because I don't have the right to do this, 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 or this. And my husband maybe tells me that I'm not as smart as him and I can't get a job, or like I'm not allowed to work because I'm considered intellectually inferior, or I'm not allowed to drive because people are worried that my uterus makes me unstable, right? Like, right. And I think what's interesting is we look at that and think like, oh my God, lol, how ridiculous. Like, of course I don't feel that way. And I think what's really important to recognize is like, well, you know, what, like, well, where are the shades of truth in that? Right. And so that's where the questions really come in. And I talk about this example, being a young woman, and this is actually about race and racism, right? Like, I was the director of this like series of monologues by women of color, and I decided to write my own monologue and share it in the show as well. And I just kept coming back, you know, it could have been on anything, but I kept coming back to my breasts and particularly my nipples. So I have, like, I'm Mexican and Iranian, and I have, you know, dark skin and I have brown nipples. And for years, I had this extraordinary shame around them. And like, you know, if a lover saw them and commented on the color, like I would blush. And I just kind of had this like really specific feeling that pink nipples were prettier and that my nipples were different and weird or ugly, or I don't know. And it's fascinating, right? As I'm telling this story, it's so obvious in retrospect what was happening, right? I was having an internalized racist response to my education and white supremacy. And yet at the time, I could not allow myself to see it, right? I had grown up in an era where I was singing songs about how I could grow up to be president, right? I grew up in an era where I was told that racism didn't exist, right? I mean, like all these kinds of things. So I'm being told this by my culture. Meanwhile, I'm having an internalized racist response to my own body, and I can't make the connection, right? Because it goes against what the culture has been telling me about my life and my world, right? So what does it mean? What does it mean to recognize that I'm having a racist response to my own body? What does that say about the culture? And so I'm not allowing myself to see it, right? Because then I would have to admit that the culture was lying. This is an extraordinary act of treason, right? Right. And so I think what we don't realize is the magnitude of allowing ourselves to see the truth. It means to be a culture traitor. It means to look at the truth and to refuse and to recognize that like people are lying to you on a grand scale, right? And I think it's like terrifying. It's a terrifying prospect that the television is lying to you, that the president is lying to you about like the state. Well, our current president isn't, but like our current president like unveiling truths that like had been obscured for so long, right? But like, what does it mean, especially as a woman? And for me as a woman of color and a fat person, right, what does it mean to sort of look out at the culture and say, I don't believe that my life is my best interest is your best interest. I don't think we share a best interest. And that's huge, right? So anyway, I'm kind of like writing this monologue and I'm not allowing myself to see the truth of it. So I'm kind of writing around the truth. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it's just that I think that brown is like not as pretty as pink. And like, that's totally fine. Like, it's totally okay to like the pink crayon more than the brown crayon, right? Or like, I was kind of like again, just like I was sabotaging myself from the understanding. And then, you know, after I wrote that piece and kind of was unable to accept what was happening, it was like the question kept burning in my head. And it wasn't until about 2 years later that I was finally able to say, you know, this is self-hatred. And I learned it from my culture. And like when I look at my brown nipples and feel like they're shameful or unattractive, that is me acting on the knowledge that I was taught. And so, and that is racism. And so it was this extraordinary moment of reckoning, and it was very powerful, right? To just essentially say, I know, culture, that you're telling me that we're post racism and we're post this and we're post that. But the truth is we're not, because if we were, I wouldn't feel this way about my nipples. And so then what does it mean to, like, you know, bring that critique and bring that spirit of inquiry to all the things around you? And so, I mean, I think, you know, to bring it back, obviously this is, you know, talking about my body and my nipples and stuff is very gendered as well, right? Because why does it matter what my nipple color is, right? Because I have to be attractive to a man and I have to be competitive for male sexual desire.
Yes.
And I understand intrinsically that having darker skin makes me less competitive, quote unquote, in like the sexual market, especially in a place like San Francisco where there's like a lot of affluent white people. You know, that's a little bit of a deep dive into like a process for me, more around race, but certainly around gender. But like, I think for me, coming into an awakening around the fact that diet culture was specifically sold to me because I was a woman, and that it was through the idea, a lot of the reasons I dieted for so long was because I thought that I had to do it for men to love me or find me attractive. Absolutely. And like, that is right. Like the idea that you would be pursuing someone who's completely okay with you not eating, or you not living life in a way that's authentic in the body that you're meant to have. That's not love. Right. And I think that there's just so much enveloped in all of it. But I think like really allowing myself to come into the awakening that I was specifically sold diet culture, as a woman, because right, like there is this real cultural obsession with controlling women's desire, women's dreams, right? And like when we're constantly outputting emotional, psychological, spiritual, physical energy into being as thin as possible, we're losing at least 80% of our bandwidth, at least, right? Like, and I think back on the days when I was dieting, it was all I ever thought about. All I ever thought about, you know, I mean, like literally when I was going to eat next, what I was going to eat, how it was going to affect me, what I needed to do to offset that food. That's obsessive thinking. And it's completely normalized. It is completely normalized. And in fact, it is aggrandized. It is rewarded when women behave that way. And what does that say about our culture? That like the culture is completely fine with women giving away 80% at least of our bandwidth and our resources. That's not a culture that's on our side. And that's what sexism looks like.
Something that hit me really hard as you were talking right there, specifically at the end too, was how often in my life in the past, I entered into a relationship with someone who was completely okay with me consistently denying myself pleasure, joy, and a sense of freedom.
Yes.
In order to look a certain way that served their ego.
Yes.
And like, that is like, why would I want to be in an intimate relationship with someone who sees the denial of my pleasure and my body trust and my joy as a good thing?
Yes.
And yet, like, our entire culture is structured around that's the sign of a good relationship.
Yes.
Someone, yes. Right? Someone who's going to be like, go you. How about you have that smaller portion so that you fit into that smaller dress size for me?
Yes.
You know, it's like, God, what a mind fuck.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like through sexism, right, like women are rendered commodities that belong to men. And so, right, like they have to, and they're, you know, and all that matters is the intimacy between men and the competition between them, because they're the ultimate, like the primary citizen. Right. And so, right. Like, so the idea is that this woman is meant to be witnessed by other men and create a sense of like envy or pride or camaraderie. Right. And like, this is extraordinarily dehumanizing. And like the idea that, I mean, it's so astounding to me, and that, like, you know, I see women striving so hard to become as small as possible in order to find some, what they've been taught is love, but what actually isn't love, right? It's like a conformity pact that you're you know, and I'm like, it's different, right? It's that's not what love is, right? But like, I don't know, it's hard kind of watching women in this cycle of self-destruction, and then maybe sometimes getting the thing they think they wanted, and it's not at all what they thought it was. It's not at all what they were told it was going to be. It's actually really, you know, disgusting and sad and disheartening and wrong, right? Because the thing that I often reflect back on, right, is like, you know, if you're losing weight in order to, or you're dieting or weight cycling or whatever, right, like in order to find love, like the contract doesn't ever end. It's not like the minute you find the love, you can go back to sort of finally eating pancakes. It's like, that's not how that works. Right. Yeah. Like you're just expected to do it forever and ever and ever. And I remember, you know, I remember one of my big awakening moments was, sitting down, you know, at my kitchen table, being in my 20s, and I was still dieting. I was, working, I had just come back from my gym and I was sweaty and it was gross, right? And like, and all I wanted was a dessert, but I knew that I couldn't have one because it would undo the workout that I had just undo, quote unquote, the workout. And like, also, and then I started to think, like, well, geez, I know I can't have a cupcake now, but when yes. can I have one in like 6 months? Then I was like, no. Then I was like, a year? And I was like, no. I was like, 5 years? I was like, no. And then I was like, 10 years? And I kept going until I reached the end of my life, you know? And the answer was still no. And I mean, it's just like, I don't know how you, I mean, I think what's so astounding, what's so incredible about diet culture is like, it keeps you in that moment. It keeps you in that, like it keeps you in the struggle and the drive, like the hunger keeps you in that way. And you can't think logically about how this is going to extrapolate out 70 years from now or 50 years from now, or 30 years from now. All you're so hungry and unhappy that all you can think about is making it to the next day that you're also not going to have a donut, but that like might be slightly better than today, you know, like it's just that bad. And I just sort of, I think people don't realize like this is the mindset of people who are deeply distressed, right? Yeah. Like they don't see it, you know?
Yeah. And what's coming up for me too, of this thought of like, well, I never get to actually have the cupcake, is if you do give in and you do decide to go off of the diet and to find joy and to do whatever it is, then you're seen as letting yourself go, which is
a reason
to be cheated on or left, right?
Yes. Like,
because that's the definition of love, I guess. It's just like, I don't know. It, the more that you talk about it, the more I can just hear the blatant disregard for the humanity of others that's present in this exchange of like, well, I love you now because you look this way. And if that changes, well, all bets are off. I'm going to go be an asshole and sleep around with these people over here because I don't actually care about you. I just care about the social asset like that you bring to my life by looking a certain way.
Yes. I mean, I think this really gets to the contractual nature of like heteronormativity, like, and the idea, right? Like the idea that a relationship between a man and a woman or like is the ultimate relationship. And like, right. And and that there's this kind of silent, but there's a silent component, but there's also a very explicit component of the contractual nature of what we've been taught is love. And like that contract has been utterly normalized. Like it's totally normal for a person to have like particular body expectations or any number of kinds of expectations, that are about like social conformity, and that's completely enveloped in our understanding of what love is and what it looks like. And that's very scary to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, what rings so true for me is because of these stories that so many of us have taken into our bones, you know, and not because we're wrong, because the culture literally gives us these messages nonstop for our entire lives.
Yes.
It's like, if I can't conform, then I need to overachieve to prove my worthiness in all these other ways. So I need to do all of this caretaking. I need, yes, to do all this emotional labor. I need to do, you know, I need to have no boundaries. I need to, yes, do all these extra sexual things. I need to be the cutest, the funniest, the smartest, the, yes, easygoingest, chillest.
Oh, yes. Oh my God. Me. Chillest. Yes.
Right. Chill. Yeah. Like fuck chill. Oh my, yeah, God. I hate,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
so
fuck
much.
Chill. Exactly.
Fuck chill. Right. But it's just like, right. You know, it's like, it's because I know inherently that I'm not worthy of these things. If I'm in a fat body, that's the message. Then I have to perform all these other things 10,000% better than a thin person in order to just get a little bit of love and recognition.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I mean, speaking of chill, it's funny because I've been talking to my friends recently. I was like, when do you decide to come out as not chill? Do you just like right out the gate? Or do you wait, yep, till like encounter number 3? Listen, we need to talk about something. I'm not chill. I just, because it's like, I mean, I don't know. It's so frustrating to me to like know that that's the prevailing expectation.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, you should not be chill in the face of sexist, racist, fat phobia. Right? Like, you just shouldn't. You shouldn't be chill.
Right.
And you shouldn't have to deal with anybody who, and I think what's really hard is like, right, like, and I talk about this in the book is like, you see, right, like we see sexism in the way that men, that like men engage with dating, like it's like cisgender or heterosexual men engage with dating, and the way that like this expectation of chill, it's like the 21st century version of, you don't get to have any expectations of me because you're inferior. But do you see how like the language has shifted? And so now all of a sudden you just feel crazy, like admitting that that's actually what's happening. And you sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Oh my God.
Like I'm single right now and dating, and like just seeing that expectation over and over again and being like, yep, this is exactly what it was. And sometimes in my mind, I think like, holy shit, if it were 1950, we'd be talking about this in overt terms about what's really happening, because the 21st century, and like feminism is considered, like some level of feminism and women's liberation is considered like, polite or whatever, you know, like normal. I don't know. We have the language has shifted, but the behavior hasn't. Anyway, I derail question a little bit, but continue.
One of the other things that I was thinking about as you were talking about, like, when do I reveal I'm not chill?
Yes.
Was never, FYI, folks. But, you know, it was like, I had a distinct period in my life, right around the time that I actually started this podcast. So it was maybe like 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago, where I had reached a place where in my life I felt I couldn't possibly be seen as sexy or desirable in my fat body. And, yeah, so I stayed in a relationship that was very unhealthy and where I was very unhappy because it seemed like that was the best it was going to get. And then I, yeah, kind of reached a tipping point where I'd rather be alone and lonely than in this relationship anymore. And I ended it. And then I started just hooking up with folks. And I started realizing that so many of these men were really interested in having incredible sex with me in the shadows, but they didn't want to be seen with me publicly.
Yes.
And to me at that point in my life, that still felt like a win.
Yeah.
Like it felt like, well, they might not want to take me out for dinner or introduce me to their friends, but I'm getting touched and I'm getting told that I'm sexy and I'm getting all these orgasms and they're treating me to fancy hotel rooms. And so I guess it's okay to be the dirty little secret because I'm feeling special.
Yeah.
And, you know, then getting to a point where now, like, fuck that shit. I don't have time for that.
Yes.
You know, like, I really truly would rather not have someone in my life than have someone in my life who feels like I need to be treated like a secret because I'm just that gruesome to the people in their lives. You know, and like, that just totally hits me when I think about that chill stuff of like, I only want people in my life that I can be vulnerable with and who can see the traumas and the stories that I show up with and are curious about those and aren't going to shy away from that. And it might be rare to find, but feeling like a hidden secret, you know, whether it's because you're trans or you're gay and closeted or because you're fat and people don't want to be seen with you, whatever it is, like ultimately that ends up becoming deeply traumatic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I'm thinking of a few things like, I have a column called Take the Cake. And one of the articles I wrote was, it was actually like offering a blank invoice for emotional labor, that fat people do. And so, I mean, I encourage you, you know, to find it and to like download the blank invoice and either like just have like either print out, you know, 100 and just give them to people who are asking you to do emotional labor. Or just kind of pin it, right? Like pin it in your mind or in your office or whatever. And just like remind yourself, right? Like that if someone is enlisting you, whether they're explicitly asking you or not, they're enlisting you into doing unfair labor because they are invested in your inferiority and your service to them. So just like keep that in mind and really ask yourself, do I actually want to be doing this? And the answer is usually no, right? And so, you know, I think that there's like, I'm thinking of that. And I'm also thinking about the ways in which there's this like very, so I recently wrote something about essentially thin people who romantically exploit fat people. And like, I was talking to a lot of fat friends and they were talking about this very particular phenomenon that happened again and again and again, where and often straight cisgender men were asking them to like essentially like doing things like, you know, like I had a friend who told me she had a colleague who would randomly when like after hours, after everybody had gone home except her and him, he would come in to talk with her with his shirt off.
What?
You know, and then and then he would, and this is a fat woman who's telling me this story, and you know, he would then ask her for like romantic advice about his wife. Or like a situation that I experienced in my early 20s. And this kind of goes to that really weird dynamic where I had a coworker, also a straight cisgender man, you know, very attractive. And this is the thing, a lot of times the stories are about thin, quote unquote, attractive men, right? Like doing this to fat women. So anyway, this coworker and I, it was so odd. He was very quote unquote desirable, right? Like a lot of my thin colleagues went out of their way to show romantic interest in him and flirt with him and do things for him. But what was happening in like when we would have meetings, he and I alone, he would like out of nowhere, we'd just be talking about work, out of nowhere, he would like kind of like scoot in closer to me and he would start like, he would like pretend to tickle me around my crotch, like for, you know, like 15 seconds and then just stop and go back to the meeting and then like do it again out of and sometimes he would do it in front of our colleagues, you know, like an after work social thing. And it was just wild, right? So, and the flurry of emotions that it caused in me, like this, like I felt like special, like you're talking, I felt like desired, but I also felt ashamed. I felt like I was, it was maddening, right? Because I could, like the whole set of behaviors was so strange. The fact that like he never verbally acknowledged what was happening. He never verbally acknowledged his desire or attraction to me. He never like, You know, there was never any like recognition of what happened. And then he would do it in front of other people and they would act like it wasn't happening. Right. Because like they themselves were probably having cognitive dissonance that this hot dude would be doing this fat girl. And so they just kind of discarded the data, you know, or whatever. And so it's just right. Like, and so anyway, I was just talking to a lot of people and they were like, these stories were consistent, right? Like people, you know, like literally, essentially like thin dudes asking fat women to go on dates, but then pretending that it wasn't a date mm-hmm. and then just wanting to hang out with them for hours alone. So, I mean, we're talking a little bit about a middle ground between, like sort of like, it's not exactly right. Like this person is full on having sex with you in a hotel room and then hiding you from their friends. What they're doing is like they're romantically gaslighting a person over a long period while also definitely passing, like crossing the line of platonic, yeah. but always keeping the behavior within the realm of plausible deniability, and then acting shocked when that person wants to go on a date or kiss or anything else, right? And they're shocked that this is like what, like, and it's just horrible. I mean, essentially, right, this is exploitation. And so I understand completely, right? Like, and I talk about this. In this particular piece that I wrote about it, where exploitation is the marriage of entitlement and disempowerment. And so what happens is the entitled person believes that the fat person is inferior and that their body, their mind, their spirit, their resources, and their dignity belong to them. And then disempowerment is what happens when fat phobia creates a lived reality where fat people feel less than human. And this creates a reality where we're less likely to advocate for ourselves. We don't understand our worth. We don't see our resources as actual resources that need to be protected and boundaried. And so a lot of times what happens is that marriage, I think the component, maybe the silent component that I'm sensing in this conversation is also the very specific way that fat people, especially fat straight women, are taught to pursue thin men. And so there's already in that, right? There's already an inferiority that's built into the desire.
Yeah.
And then the person, the thin man, both has male privilege and thin privilege, and sometimes, you know, cisgender privilege or any white privilege or any other number of things. And they know that that's the dynamic. They sense that's the dynamic, and they sense that they have the upper hand and they take advantage, right? And so it's kind of this like dual, very, I mean, right, like it's difficult to call it, it's right, like on the one hand, desire is part of it, but on the other hand, there's another bigger control power dynamic that's happening that's actually probably the bigger component in the exchange. And so what ends up happening is there's like it creates a cycle because the person loves the feeling of power, and some part of us, like as a subjugated, you know, like maybe in the thin person's mind, and as the subjugated, like, you know, oppressed that person, some part of us is like, oh, it feels so good to feel recognized by someone who's superior to me, who's a representative of a successful citizen in our culture.
Yeah.
And so we get to access a sense of belonging through that, you know?
Yes. Yes. I think that's so crucial is, you know, if I can't access the privilege and the resources myself, and then if I can be in a relationship with someone who does access them, then I'm closer and more likely to also get some of that access.
Yes, exactly.
Which I think, you know, I think is often just really this unspoken survival.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know, technique. And I think it also just kind of speaks to, you know, before we hopped on for the interview, one of the things you were talking about is kind of like the way that dating and romance and the politic of fatness never really leaves the room, and how so often the people that you date don't want to really contextualize your exchange and like all of the things you're bringing into the room with you. And I think that's so important to name too, of, you know, we carry our traumas with us. And that can make for such rich, interesting experiences.
Yeah.
But when the lived experience and the trauma is denied or downplayed, it can feel so invisibilizing.
Yeah.
And so I think that's just I don't know, just important for people listening to hear that the stories you bring with you might be ugly and they might hurt and they might be scary to someone who doesn't have those same experiences, but those stories inform so much of who you are. And if you want to like honestly connect with another human being, you have to be able to like see those things as present and to be able to talk about them and to share experiences and to have people who just don't want to go there.
Right.
I think is really frustrating.
Oh yeah. I mean, essentially, right. Like it's not fair when someone it's not fair or right when someone asks you to only bring certain parts of yourself to the table. On the one hand, right. Like I think it's important to set boundaries, right. And say like, okay, like I'm somebody who, I'm somebody who's a codependent, a recovering codependent. And so my tendency has been like, date one, I'm going to tell you every single thing about me that makes me, right? And like, I think that yeah. through that, right, like I was trying to create vulnerability and trust, but what was happening was, I was leaving myself extraordinarily vulnerable to people I didn't know. Like you can't give away the keys to the castle. And I think one of the things that's so fascinating and hard and complicated for me, and I think others, is like, as a woman, as a person of color, as a fat person, I don't even realize I'm giving away the keys to the castle because I haven't been taught that I have a castle.
Yeah.
And the truth is, right, like we have lived experiences that are very rich and very valuable. And that's the castle, right? And like treat the castle like it's a fucking castle and like don't let everybody in. And so I think like on the one hand, right, it's important to recognize what kind of boundaries do I need to have in order to protect myself and not give away too much too soon in order to protect my heart, not in order to protect another person's ego or whatever, but to protect you, right? Because you're precious and worthy of being taken care of. But like specifically, right, like what a lot of times people ask for is that we not bring up any parts of our life that implicate them. I feel like that, and I mean, I'm going to speak to this on a personal level as someone who does a lot of straight dating. Like I date a lot of straight cisgender men. And a lot of times what I've noticed is that, you know, a lot of times they're very willing to hear me out on my fatness. They're very, you know, they're sympathetic. They're very loving and caring. And I've been very moved by like men's capacity, by the men I've dated anyway, their capacity to caretake me around that. But if I want to talk about what it's like dealing with men, they shut down quite quickly, right? So like, I mean, I had a situation recently where I was dating someone who I was head over heels for, right? Like completely and utterly just enamored of this person. I'd never felt that way before with anybody. And things were going really, really well. And he was holding me so well around my fatness. And he read all my work. And he admired me so much and very clearly. And then, you know, it got to a point in our exchange where I needed to talk to him about the tension of straight dating, right? The tension of what it means to be intimately involved with a man when as a woman in this culture. And I opened up to him and said, there is a tension to heterosexual exchange because you're always going to have more power and access than I am. And it's very difficult. It's a big ask to give complete trust to someone who will always have more versatility and who is always considered more valuable than me in this culture. And he just could not hear it, right? Like, I'm like, this is my lived experience. I have to live with this truth every day. And you at 33 have to hear it for the first time and have compassion rather than be defensive and accept that this is my lived reality as a woman. And you just can't do it because it implicates you. You like, he didn't feel implicated as a fatphobe, right? Like, you know, he felt defensive and like protective of me against fatphobia. But once I was like, you too, like, yeah. It's you too. Like you know, whether you want to admit it or whether you're actively participating in it or not, you are a beneficiary of sexism. I cannot date someone who refuses to see my reality And it had to end, right? Because I'm like, you cannot even take accountability for what's really happening in my life. And I understand that it hurts to hear that you're part of something that's hurting me, but like your refusal to do it, your refusal to like, to be empathetic, to be sympathetic, to hear me, and to not make this about you is an indication that you're not here for me as a full person. And I'm just not going to deal with that, you know?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's amazing. And I also know that a lot of people listening are probably deeply uncomfortable with that. And that's a great thing.
Yes, for sure.
Like what would change in our world if in the relationships we had the skills and we had the space to be able to process those kinds of conversations, knowing they were going to hurt, knowing they were going to be uncomfortable, knowing we were going to get triggered and defensive, knowing we might be mad at each other for a little while and mad at the world for a little while, but to still be able to have a connected, committed relationship structure that could hold those kinds of conversations. Like, what a fucking world that would be.
Yes. Well, and I think a lot of it for me, it starts with recognizing how much bargaining power we actually have.
Yeah.
Like how much we're actually bringing to the table. And the truth is, right, like I think if you're a woman and if you're a fat person, right, like you think that you're bringing like 3 pennies to the table. And that's why we do so much like side bargaining, right, where it's like, okay, I only have 3 pennies, but I'm totally willing to not have boundaries for you. Or I only have 3 pennies, but I'll work all these extra hours that are not compensated. And we're not recognizing that it's actually not 3 pennies that we're bringing. We're bringing like this enormous treasure trove. And that we can act from that place, that we can recognize that that's what we're bringing, and we can act like we know it. You know what I mean? And yeah. I think for me, that's been a huge step in my journey.
Oh God, I love that. I just want to kind of like sit in that and think about like, what would that look like for me even, you know, like I've certainly grown so much over the past handful of years in this space, but there's still places where I apologize, or if not explicitly inside, I can feel an apology sitting there. And to kind of do that shift of like, I'm bringing a whole fucking treasure chest.
Yes.
And, like, there's some rich stuff here, folks. So, you know, like F the apologies. You don't have to like me, but I've got some awesome things that we can roll around in and delight in. I think that's a really beautiful shift that could offer people some big permission.
Yeah. And I think that the corollary of it that I want to offer on that is, and then you've got to stop fucking with people who don't want to see your treasure trove. And that's the hard part, right? It's like, like what we're taught to do is to go after the person who's telling us we have 3 pennies.
Yep.
And to shift the dynamic and say, I have a treasure trove and I'm only fucking with people who see my treasure trove. Yep. And like that might mean like radical shifting around your work practice, your dating practice, and your friendship practice. Those are big things.
Yes. Oh my God. Well, to everybody who's listening, I hope you just like chew on that for a while and really think about what that would mean. And more importantly, what it would mean to decide, I really am only going to spend time and energy on people who can show up for me in the ways that I deserve.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a really big question, I think, to end on. I have so many other things that I totally want to talk to you about, but I want to respect your time and our listeners' time. So Virgie, can you tell everyone how they can stay in touch with you and find you online if they want to like read all the things and follow along with your adventures?
Yeah. So the first thing is, please buy my book. It's called You Have the Right to Remain Fat. It's out by the Feminist Press, and you can get it on Amazon or anywhere books are sold. You can find me online at www.virgietovar.com, VirgieTovar.com. And then I'm also pretty active on Instagram at VirgieTovar.
Yay! And also totally be sure to check out your column, Take the Cake.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Take the Cake on ravishly.com.
So much good stuff there. Such a backlog of awesome pieces. So everyone go check that out too if you're hungry for more, because we want to feed our hunger.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Virgie, and sharing all of this. This was like the most delicious brain sex ever. I loved it.
Yes. Oh my God. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. And to everybody who tuned in, thank you so much for listening. Remember, if you support the show on Patreon at $3 or above, patreon.com/sexgetsreal, head over there now to get your bonus content. I'm going to do a little reading from Virgie's book and then do some more sharing and some more theorizing around these topics around fatness and sex and pleasure and all that good stuff. So go check that out. If you have any questions for me, head to sexgetsreal.com to submit those. You can do that anonymously. And of course, until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah with Virgie Tovar. Bye.